Please turn with me tonight to Job chapter 37. Job chapter 37, as we conclude the speeches of the young man Elihu. And we essentially catch Elihu in mid-praise as we join chapter 37 in verse 1. The extended praise of God by Elihu began back in chapter 36, right around verse 22, where he says, "Behold, God is exalted in His power, who is a teacher like Him." And it continues on through our present chapter tonight to the end of chapter 37. And it really constitutes one of the most sublime passages in all of Scripture. Again, this is another one of the great high points of the book of Job. Here, Elihu makes very few references to Job, except at one point where he calls him by name and says, "Hear this, O Job, stop and consider the wondrous works of God." The rest of the time, he refers to Job indirectly, and even for Elihu, rather kindly at one point toward the end. He is instead caught up in praising God, and we cannot read the chapter before us tonight without joining him, for what he says about God is right. And the reason that the passage is so powerful is that it seems to be spoken as an actual storm is brewing. You classical music lovers may know Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, his pastoral symphony, and there's a movement that's very fast and merry, sort of indicating maybe something like a picnic in the countryside, and then all of a sudden it begins to be interrupted by music that suggests an occasional raindrop or two. And then it's back to the merrymaking, and then more music that suggests raindrops, and then before long you're into a full-fledged orchestral storm. Well, it's kind of similar here in the book of Job, because in chapter 36, verse 27, Elihu began to mention something. He said, "For he draws up the drops of water, they distill his mist in rain, which the skies pour down and drop on mankind abundantly." This seems to be the beginning of the change in the weather during this particular speech. And Elihu makes the most of it, like I always do on the very few times that we have a thunderstorm during a sermon on Sunday morning. It seems appropriate to try to match what's being said to the atmospheric conditions. The Elihu begins to go higher and higher in his estimation of God, connecting him rightly so with the lightning and the thunder and so on, until by the end of the chapter, there is a whirlwind blowing, and as you know, the Lord finally answers Job out of that whirlwind. So, things begin in verse 27, and I'd like to just start there, back in chapter 36. "For he draws up the drops of water, they distill his mist in rain, which the skies pour down and drop on mankind abundantly. Can anyone understand the spreading of the clouds, the thunderings of his pavilion? Behold, he scatters his lightning about him and covers the roots of the sea. For by these he judges peoples. He gives food in abundance." And this is a theme that Elihu is going to elaborate on in just a few verses. that by the same event, God can do two different things. He can be judging people by the storm that He sends upon them. He can also, at the same time, be sending that storm to provide much-needed rain for His elect. So He does so often two different functions in the same event. And our God is certainly not limited to two. Verse 29. Can anyone understand the spreading of the clouds, the thunderings of His pavilion? Behold, He scatters lightning about Him and covers the roots of the sea. For by these He judges peoples. He gives food in abundance. He covers His hands with the lightning and commands it to strike the mark. Its crashing declares His presence. The cattle also declare that He rises. It's interesting to even imagine Elihu, Job, and the three friends, perhaps in some open place where they can see a herd of cattle reacting to the coming storm. And Elihu says in verse 1, "At this also my heart trembles and leaps out of its place." He has called attention to the storm, and now his heart is pounding as he comments on what is taking place all around them. Keep listening to the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. It's very graphic in the NIV. Listen, listen to the roar of his voice, to the rumbling that comes from his mouth. And verse 3 says, "Under the whole heaven, he lets it go." Isn't that a great line? He lets it go. This is the thunder that is equivalent to the Lord's voice. He lets it go and his lightning to the corners of the earth. After it, his voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice. And he does not restrain the lightnings when his voice is heard. God thunders wondrously with his voice, verse 5. He does great things that we cannot comprehend. Do you think of any other passages that speak of the Lord making himself known in a storm? Excuse me?
When Elijah was looking for the Lord, he didn't find him in different places, but in still small.
Yes, Elijah experienced the storm and an earthquake and fire and so on, and he might have expected that the Lord might have been in those things, and the Lord certainly caused them, but it was not in those things that the Lord chose to speak to Elijah. What about the great 29th Psalm? Do you remember that? Psalm 29. Let's turn there for just a moment. Verse 3, "The voice of the Lord is over the waters, the God of glory thunders. The voice of the Lord is powerful, the voice of the Lord is full of majesty." I love verses 7 and 8, "The voice of the Lord flashes forth like flames of fire, the voice of the Lord shakes the wilderness, the Lord shakes the wilderness of Kadesh. The voice of the Lord makes the deer give birth and strips the forests bare, and in his temple all cry glory. The Lord sits enthroned over the flood. The Lord sits enthroned as king forever. May the Lord give strength to his people. May the Lord bless his people with peace." As a matter of fact, when we studied that psalm, we noted that another possible translation of verse 10 is that the Lord sat enthroned over the flood. That it's saying, in other words, that if he was the God who was behind the flood in Noah's day, he certainly is enthroned over whatever lesser floods we have until the end of history. He sits enthroned as king forever. And in the psalm is the great contrast, you know, with the way it ends in verse 11. "May the Lord give strength to his people. May the Lord bless his people with peace." So the same God who rides upon the storm, as we sang about in that great hymn tonight, is also the same Lord who gives strength to His people and blesses His people with shalom, with peace that passes understanding, the peace that is absolutely incomprehensible, the peace of God that guards our hearts and minds. It's fascinating how the Bible would juxtapose two ideas like that together, because the Lord is sovereign over every cataclysmic event of nature, and yet He is responsible for the peace that you and I know. All right, let's go back to Job 37. And one of the key points, I think, in verse 5 is that He does great things that we cannot comprehend. He does great things beyond our understanding. Anybody want to comment on those first 5 verses about the Lord being over the storm, thundering with His voice, and hurling the lightning? So we come to verse 6. We see that we have here every sort of atmospheric condition, including harsh ones. For to the snow, He says, fall on the earth. You read Matthew's Uncle Steve's newsletter a few weeks ago. This verse brings him comfort as he has to shovel snow in Indiana. He remembers who says, fall on the earth, to the snow. To the snow, He says, fall on the earth. Likewise to the downpour. And the interesting thing about it is that the downpour is described in this way. And perhaps if we learn to think in terms of Elihu's expressions, we might do a little better. He says, likewise to the downpour. In other words, He commands the downpour, but then a very important phrase is introduced. It's His downpour. It's His downpour. So, it's not a downpour that is just coming about from the right convergence of conditions, with warm fronts meeting cold fronts and all of that sort of thing that we've been watching nightly on the news now for all these many days. He's in control of this, and the downpours are His mighty downpours. Remember that next time you have a commute like you did this morning. It's His mighty downpour, and He is sovereign over it. Verse 7 is interesting in the ESV. They take it quite literally. The Hebrew literally says, He seals up the hand of every man, that all men whom He made may know it. What do you suppose that means? He seals up the hands of every man. The NIV users are keeping quiet. They're waiting for the rest of us to guess it.
Says He stops every man from labor.
Yeah, that's what that means. In other words, there are times when it's not fit for man nor beast, and nobody can go out. Nobody can go forth to do their labor because of either a downpour or a blizzard or some sort of terrific weather event. That all men whom He made may know it. What's the lesson that those who are, as we say, providentially hindered from coming to work are supposed to learn?
Be still and know that I am God.
Be still and know that I am God. Absolutely. In other words, that they may know that He is the one who is in charge of the weather. We called Barbara's brother during a severe ice storm up in Portland, Oregon. He lives in Portland, and the ice storm was so bad that all of the interstates going into and out of Portland were closed. Trucks were simply stopped on the interstate. The drivers were inside trying to stay warm as best they could. No one could go anywhere. No one could do anything. And my brother-in-law was simply hoping that the electricity would stay on through the night. But he had his candles ready and his fireplace stoked in case it didn't happen. In other words, it's an example of what we see every winter at some place, but especially up north in this particular winter that we've gone through. Sometimes whole cities are just brought to a standstill, brought to their knees. And the idea behind that is that they will think about God, that they will turn their thoughts to the Lord, because all men whom He made are supposed to know who is in sovereign control over the weather. Verse 8. Then the beasts go into their lairs and remain in their dens. Now, there are a few beasts here tonight who would sure like to do that on some of these winter days we've been having. Well, the animals know. They take cover, it says in the NIV. They remain in their dens. Verse 9. From its chamber comes the whirlwind. It's like God has this whirlwind locked up in a chamber and brings it out at the appropriate time. That is the picture. From its chamber comes the whirlwind and cold from the scattering winds. By the breath of God, ice is given, and the broad waters are frozen fast. Some of you have seen frozen rivers. That's an amazing sight, isn't it? To see rivers and lakes frozen over. You can hardly imagine how that could be. I was privileged to go to Canada a number of years ago, and it was the month of May, the very end of May, and we went up to Lake Louise and were absolutely amazed that it was still frozen, solid, even that late in our Texas spring. And this ice comes from God. The Bible doesn't shrink back, nor does it fudge and talk as if God gives the good weather and Satan sends the bad weather. God sends it all. It is to Him that glory goes for His might and power. The cold from the scattering winds, by the breath of God, ice is given, and the broad waters are frozen fast. He loads the thick cloud with moisture. The clouds scatter His lightning. This is quite advanced understanding, isn't it, for a book that is this ancient. The understanding of the content of the clouds here. He loads the thick cloud with moisture. This is why scientists are constantly amazed when they really understand the Bible, that it does not contradict true science. He loads the thick cloud with moisture. The clouds scatter His lightning. And they turn around and round. In other words, they make a whirlwind. They swirl at His guidance to accomplish all that He commands them on the face of the habitable world. And here is a verse worth memorizing. Verse 13. Whether for correction, or for His land, or for love, He causes it to happen. Isn't that a great verse? Whether for correction, or for His land, or for love, He causes it to happen. God has purposes in the storm. One purpose might be punishment. One purpose might be pleasure, His own pleasure. He just wants to water His land. Or providence to provide for His people. Let's think a minute about storms in the Bible that were sent to correct or to punish. Because what the Hebrew says here is for the rod. whether for the rod or for his land or for love, he causes it to happen. You think of any storms connected with correction, punishment, judgment? Do you remember the circumstances of the battle that the Israelites fought under Samuel the judge? Do you remember that the Philistines attacked the Israelites? And in 1 Samuel 7:9, it says Samuel took a nursing lamb, offered it as a whole burnt offering to the Lord, and Samuel cried out to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him. As Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to attack Israel, but the Lord thundered with a mighty sound that day against the Philistines and threw them into confusion, and they were routed before Israel. And the men of Israel went out from Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and struck them as far as below Beth-kar. Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shin and called its name Ebenezer. For he said, till now the Lord has helped us. Another famous meteorological event wasn't strictly a storm so much, was the parting of the Red Sea. And even if you'll remember the battle of the Canaanites by Judge Deborah and Barak as they went out against Sisera, that God caused a storm to happen during that battle. So God's purposes are fulfilled in the storm of a punitive nature. And sometimes He is punishing His enemies. Sometimes, as we discussed Sunday night, He may be chastening His people. We certainly don't ever and must not ever assume that when we see that huge storms have come through towns, tornadoes and so on, and destroyed houses, that these were the houses of God's enemies. Sometimes He chastens us through tragedies like that. So I think that the general term correct, encompassing both punishment and chastening, is a good translation of what's going on here. He sends storms to correct and to do His sovereign will. Then the second phrase is for His land. For His land. The Lord's just out watering. That's what He's doing. He's out taking care of His land. He's out taking care of His eretz, His land, which can mean two things. It can mean, of course, the land of Israel, but it even means more than that. It means the earth. It means the whole inhabited world. And so he's out doing things for His good pleasure. One of the things that we're going to find when God speaks to Job is that God has a sense of pleasure, and He does certain things for His good pleasure, like make an ostrich. Going to find that that's true. There's also something else that God did in terms of our salvation for His own good pleasure. And what was that? No other motivation is ascribed to Him for this amazing thing except His good pleasure. Our election. Our election to salvation. The choice of us for salvation was not based on any foresight where He looked down through time and saw whether we would or would not accept Him as Lord. He would have only seen one thing had it not been for His grace. That is, that we would not have. But it was for His own good pleasure that He chose us for salvation. So one of the things that we have to give Elihu credit for is introducing us to the idea that God just simply does some things because He likes to do them, because He is God and He has His own pleasures. And some of His pleasures are very surprising to us. For example, it pleased the Lord concerning something about Jesus that you would never have thought would please the Lord. To bruise Him. It pleased the Lord to bruise Him. He has put Him to grief. Why did it please the Lord to bruise His Son? Because He loved us so that we could be saved. So when we come to this phrase, for His land, we are reading here about the Lord simply taking care of and tending His own property, the world. And then when we read the third phrase, or for love, He causes it to happen. Well, that's the easy one, isn't it? He rains and our gardens get tended. He rains and our fields yield crops. He rains and the spring flowers come and give us joy. And do you remember that under the old covenant, under the law, He conditioned rain upon what? Obedience. Deuteronomy 11:13, if you will indeed obey my commandments that I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve Him with all your heart and with all your soul, He will give you the rain for your land in its season. The early rain and the later rain, that you may gather in your grain and your wine and your oil. And He will give grass in your fields for your livestock, and you shall eat and be full. Take care lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and He will shut up the heavens, so that there will be no rain, and the land will yield no fruit, and you will perish quickly off the good land that the Lord is giving you. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus spoke of how God made the rain fall upon the just and the unjust. You remember, He said, you've heard it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For He makes His sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love only those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same. In other words, He makes His sun rise. He sends rain on both the just and the unjust. That's the very argument that the Apostle Paul and Barnabas used when they spoke to the church at Lystra. Remember that they told them that they had been blessed by God. They said, He did good by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. Some would call this an aspect of the general love of God, not His saving love for His elect, but His general goodwill. Others would refer to it as His common grace, not His saving grace. But it is something that all people should give thanks to God for. That for His love, He causes the downpours to happen. So, verse 13 is translated in the NIV, says, He brings the cloud to punish men or to water His earth and show His love. But it misses the nuance there of the or for His land or for love. It misses the idea of God doing something for simply His own pleasure in taking care of His own property. Whether for correction or for His land or for love, He causes it to happen. Any comment on any of these verses so far? Anything you'd like to add? Okay. Yes.
Just while reading these first 13 verses, I'm astounded by two things that one, an irony in the opening verse of chapter 38, how God answers out of the whirlwind, but even more astounding, as we witnessed back during the F5 tornado in Gerald. That, you know, the three ministers that just described this tremendous tragedy to something other than God. God had nothing to do with this, and all these people were supposed to be comforted in that, right? And yet Scripture is so laden and so explicit in passages like these, Amos 3:6, Psalm 29, and Jesus our Lord Himself commanding the elements. Mm-hmm. And they would deny these people the knowledge that the assurance that God was in this for a reason, and to adjure them to seek this matter out, to humble themselves. Yet because that was not preached or rightly divided, these people had no assurance and absolutely had nothing but depression and just a negative, just a whole negative, empty explanation for what happened.
Well, and one of the causes of their depression, which they may not have even realized, is that they had just been told that they had an impotent God.
Yes.
They had just been told that they had a God who was no match for the weather conditions, who either couldn't or wouldn't prevent these things from happening. And, yes, Dave?
Well, to show that he's not, this has always been an unbelievable verse for me in Joshua when Israel was going up against the five kings to fight them, and they're fighting and slaying all these people. It says God was throwing hailstones down on these guys, and he killed more with his hailstones than Israel did with slaying them. It's just incredible. He must have been really mad at these guys.
Joshua 10:11 is what he's referring to. As they fled before Israel while they were going down the ascent of Beth Horon, the Lord threw down large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died because of the hailstones than the sons of Israel killed with the sword.
Jackson,
yes, ma'am.
I've got a story I've been thinking at, and I was hesitant to tell it because I hated to contradict the point that God sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. But when you think about God controlling the weather conditions, there was a story I remember hearing from some of the older missionaries in Zimbabwe about a time where there had been a drought there. And in one of the cities, a bunch of Christians had gathered outside on a designated day to pray for rain. And I think it was the day before that the local witch doctor had heard that they were going to do this. And so got out himself and did all his rain stuff and everything to make it rain, and I guess you could compare it to Elijah, the call down fire and everything. And the day after the missionary and all the Christians came out and prayed for rain, it rained. It rained everywhere except on the witch doctor's backyard. All around, he planted on it.
Well,
so, at the risk of contradicting the idea that God sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous, that's just such a great example of how He has perfect control over the weather.
Well, that's what He did with the plagues in Egypt. The plagues were not in Goshen, where the Israelites were. They were over all the rest of the land of Egypt. When He's trying to make a point against false gods, He sends the blessings where His people are and not where people have called upon those who are not God. All right, look at verse 14. Elihu speaks to Job directly and says, "Hear this, O Job, stop and consider the wondrous works of God." And of course, his whole point is to emphasize God's transcendence, His might, His power, and that will be what the Lord Himself will emphasize as he speaks to Job. The difference will be between the Lord and Elihu is that the Lord will not reprove Job except for one thing, for darkening counsel by words without knowledge. but he will not say that Job has a secret sin or that Job has failed to repent properly or so, or anything like that. Elihu calls on Job to stop and consider the wondrous works of God. Do you know how God lays his command upon them and causes the lightning of the cloud, of his cloud, to shine? Do you know the balancings of the clouds? What does he mean by that? The balancings.
The layers.
Layers of the clouds.
The clouds hang poised.
Now the clouds hang poised, how they hover. And God is in charge of that balancing. The balancings of the clouds, the wondrous works of him who's perfect in knowledge. And then we Texans can certainly understand verse 17, and this will rub it in not only to Job, but also to us, that we are not God. You whose garments are hot when the earth is still because of the south wind. We know what that's like, don't we, from May through October. And how much more in the Middle East, in the land of Uz. Job is, like everyone in that part of the country, the victim of the sweltering heat and the stillness that comes after the south wind. Can you, verse 18, can you, like him, spread out the skies hard as a cast metal mirror? The heavens are sometimes like brass, aren't they? And that is saying essentially the same thing. And when it says that the skies are as hard as a cast metal mirror, it's also suggesting something else besides relentless heat. What else is it speaking of? Hard as a cast metal mirror. Well, when are the skies soft?
When clouds
are in the skies. That's right. So this is talking about hard, clear, relentlessly bright skies in times of drought. Hard as a cast metal mirror. Teach us what we shall say to him. We cannot draw up our case because of darkness. At this point, Elihu changes his tone significantly. And it is almost as if, in speaking of Job's smallness before God, and then thinking of his own smallness before God, that he realizes that Job is his brother. And he does something here that ministers frequently do to kind of soften blows. Instead of a minister saying, "You're all hypocrites," he will say, "We are all hypocritical sometimes, aren't we?" Instead of saying, "You're all sinners," he will say, "We are sinners." And Elihu does that. He says, "Teach us what we shall say to him. We cannot draw up our case because of darkness." Well, first of all, who wanted to draw up a case? Job's been talking about drawing up a case for chapters. If you go back to chapter 31, verse 35, "Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder. I would bind it on me as a crown. I would give him an account of all my steps. Like a prince I would approach him." Job has been absolutely certain that he is in the right, only in the sense of not having done anything to deserve his affliction. He's not ever said that he was sinlessly perfect. But he has wanted to go to court with God and get an answer from God as to why he's gone through all this. And Elihu, in a moment of softening and brotherhood, says, "Teach us what we shall say to him. We cannot draw up our case because of darkness." Now, what does the darkness mean here? I don't think it means it's getting dark because of the storm all around us. We don't have the understanding of God. We don't have the understanding. We don't have the mind. We don't have the wisdom. We cannot draw up our case because of darkness. He said, and then Elihu does, again, an interesting pastoral thing. Job has been wanting to speak to God, but Elihu substitutes himself for Job's desire to speak. It's like he uses himself as an example. And again, this softens his counsel to Job. He says, shall it be told him that I would speak? And Elihu says, this is absolutely unthinkable. He says, did a man ever wish that he would be swallowed up? Am I really going to say that I want to speak to him? Elihu is saying, do I look stupid? He's saying, would a man ever wish that he would be swallowed up? You see the evidence of him all around you. He is bigger than we are, Job. And how can we possibly say to him that we'll draw up a case? We don't have the light. We don't have the insight. Shall it be told him that I would speak? Did a man ever wish that he would be swallowed up? Then he says in verse 21, and now no one looks on the light when it is bright in the skies, when the wind has passed and cleared them. What light is he talking about? The sunlight. He's talking about the phenomena that you will experience tomorrow in the afternoon, if the weathermen are finally right. These bands of rain have gone away. Supposedly there's going to be clearing, and for the next few days there will be some sunshine. But you can't look at the sun, can you? You can't look directly on it. You can glance at it, but you can't face the glaring brilliance of the sun. You will be blinded, especially with the slant of it this time of year. No one looks on the light when it is bright in the skies, when the wind has passed and cleared them. And he's obviously going for a comparison here. He's going for a how much more comparison. He's saying, if you can't even see his creation, the sun, when it is bright in the skies, then how are you going to look at the one who comes with golden splendor? In verse 22, out of the north comes golden splendor. God is clothed with awesome majesty. The Almighty, verse 23, we cannot find Him. He is great in power, justice and abundant righteousness He will not violate. This is another way of saying what Abraham said about God. Will not the judge of all the earth do right? He is great. He is also good. He is sovereign. He is also perfect in all of His judgments. The thesis of the book of Job is that the choice is neither God is God, but not good, or God is good, but not God. He is both God and good. And He is God, clothed with awesome majesty, coming in golden splendor. And yet, justice and abundant righteousness He will not violate. And this is good to remember when you see apparent injustice. And this is good to remember when God has permitted some unrighteous thing to happen. In His sovereign plan and in His sovereign person, justice and abundant righteousness He will not violate. Verse 24 is very hard to translate. So we have, I think, probably a number of different sorts of translations. Dave, what does your New American Standard say in verse 24?
Therefore, men, fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in heart.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is quite literal. That is word for word what the Hebrew says. The question is, how do you interpret that term, wise in heart? Because wise in heart should be a good thing. And yet, the text says, he does not regard any who is wise in heart. So there are two ways of dealing with it. One is the way the ESV does it, and that is to say that the people think they are wise in heart. So they translate, therefore men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit. You remember that phrase of the Apostle Paul that you find in the book of Romans. Be not wise in your own conceits. Well, the ESV translators have said that's what the phrase may very well mean here. That it's a person who thinks he's wise. And by implication, that would be Job. A person who thinks he has great understanding about God. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit. NIV takes another approach because there is a not in there, an N-O-T that has to be dealt with. And so they translate it as a question. Therefore men revere him, for does he not have regard for all the wise in heart? Meaning that the wise in heart are people who fear the Lord. That's the beginning of wisdom in the wisdom literature. And therefore, they are people with this quality that is to be desired. And God does have regard for all the wise in heart. So it's hard to know. The translators go with either one of those two choices, or they talk at some length about complicated textual questions of what's dropped out and what's been lost and that sort of thing. I think the general sense is clear. First of all, the first part of the verse is without question. Therefore men fear him. But they don't just fear him, and they shouldn't just fear him because he is the God of the storm. They shouldn't just fear him because he is the God of creation and the God who is over all nature. That is certainly a reason for fear, but that's not primarily the reason that sinners should fear him. Nor is it the reason that Christians should revere him. They who are sinners should fear him, and Christians should revere him, not so much because of his incredible power over nature, but because of what? What made Isaiah fear him? His holiness. His holiness. His character. This comes right after the statement has been made about his justice and abundant righteousness. It's not just that he is sovereign, not that only, but that he is good. He is perfect. He is holy. And of course, he will regard all who are wise in heart because the fear of him is the very beginning of whatever wisdom there is. So now Elihu has ended. He has brought us, as it were, over a kind of a bridge that has gone from chapter 32 through chapter 37. He has talked more about the transcendence of God, and he has tried to limit his criticism of Job only to Job's words. And yet, even he has not been completely successful because Job hasn't said some of the things that he has heard him say or accused him of meaning. But what he has done is bring us face to face with the mystery of God. And that's ultimately where this book is taking us, because at some point we who are finite creatures have to simply bow before the mystery of God. He moves in a mysterious way, His wonders to perform. And eventually we have to clap our hands over our mouth, bow our head, and say, "You are God." And it is this experience of Job's that Elihu is preparing us for, because he is now preparing us, as he watches the storm gather all around him, for God himself to break out of the whirlwind he has created and speak to his servant Job. And we will take up there next time. Do we have prayer requests tonight?